horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
We're back, and I'm back in back at the console just in time after a quick visit to the coffee bar, and I saw Will Velli going to join us, talk about bottom of the next hour, and provide an update on the H2B visa scenarios, and Shannon Kelly is who was the missing piece, like the little puzzle piece that the Curious George swallows, and when in Curious George goes to the hospital, it was Shannon Kelly from the Safety Net Foundation of the Jockey Club. Shannon, just amazing. But right now, Michelle Fisher, you don't need both.
I'm ready to talk.
There are horses that are two groom horses on both sides, and then there's two microphone guests.
That's right. Hard to handle. That's right.
Michelle was with us last night at Brightson's, and I had Dick earlier discussing that he'd been there many times, and you.
My first time.
Oh, that was your maiden breaker,
yes,
too?
Yes, yes.
I didn't know that. I didn't realize.
So I came home with a food coma as well, and I am coming out of that this morning. I'm about ready for solid food, but great meal, great atmosphere.
Really fun. I mean, it's one of those places too. The people at other tables, and of course with this gathering, whether it's people from NOLA or people that are in town, they'll gravitate there. So you get introduced to other tables. And of course, being with Neil Pessin, you're invariably going to be regaled. Everybody stops by to pay homage to Pessin.
Yeah, between the drink in his name, the plaque, and then the corner of Wynn Pictures, I think he's got that place covered.
I would say Pessin. The thing is, he's got that in about 9 restaurants around town. And I think they all share him equally. Frank and a lot of the other restaurateurs in town that he's got a whole rotation. He literally has a planner, and all the lunches and dinners are all laid out.
When I come to New Orleans, I let him decide where I'm going to eat. I just follow him around.
Put you in great hands. And speaking of following around, you follow the SIS. It's good to see you again.
It's very good to see you. Unfortunately, I missed the meal. I was still on a plane, so I was on my way in. So it was a shame that I missed that. But it's very good to be back.
Nice to see you. And we should really get an update. And every one of these gatherings does offer an opportunity on the fixed odds initiatives that continue to grind along at various paces, and it's invaluable. I mean, obviously, you come to things like this and symposium, etc., to get a critical mass of horsemen and stakeholders in the industry to update them on where things stand, because it's a fight, and you're negotiating on a going basis, depending on what the project, what the focus is. Colorado has been a big part of when you first explained to us. Was that might have been two symposiums ago?
Oh, not quite.
Was it?
When
did we have the Colorado discussion?
It was the last time at Oaklawn, wasn't it?
Yeah, we talked last year.
Oh, there you go. So it was at the HBPA Oaklawn last year. All right.
I feel it's not a conference unless I'm here talking about fixed odds, and I really hope there'll be a day when we're looking at numbers instead of talking about the idea of it. But there has been a lot of work quietly being done in the background. And it's not just about, you said a fight. It's not just about a fight. I think it's more about education. You look at the U.S. market, and we have been predominantly pari-mutuel since the 1800s, when we outlawed bookmaking back in that time. And it's an education for both horsemen here, for racetracks. Everyone's worried about what they have being taken away. Sometimes we need to take that conversation and change it to what we could have. And we wouldn't be here talking about fixed odds on horse racing if it wasn't for sports betting. You know, we're now into 36 states in the District of Columbia. And as that marches forward, I looked at a stat the other day, and I think there's 130 million people in the United States that can legally bet on sports wagering if they want to. It's a lot of people.
That's just about half.
And when you look at it that way, you think, well, how do we get horse racing in front of these people? And for the racing industry and for this group here at the HBPA, how do we get them in front of people, and how do we make sure that purses and racetracks are compensated accordingly? And we just have to get to that point.
The New Jersey example, and every time we have this conversation, it's hard not to hearken back to the Betfair experience in market exchange wagering experience. And again, I use the same word, the third time it's been used this morning, critical mass, in terms of having enough liquidity to make a market viable. And is that the central core challenge?
No, the challenge is this. You know, the Betfair exchange wagering in New Jersey was before its time. It was before PASPA was repealed. Okay. There really wasn't a culture. What we have now is a culture of bettors. It's a culture that's quickly growing. People are betting on everything under the sun, football, basketball, all the time. It's almost to the point where it's invading our lives through advertising, sponsorships, and that's going to be raked back some in the coming year. But it's not like Parimutuel, we talk about liquidity, but for fixed odds, it's not about liquidity. It's more about adding horse racing to the catalog of sports wagers. It's having the industry agree to put our racing onto a sports book. So it's not the mechanicals that are difficult at this point. It's the industry wanting to move forward.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. We need to get an alignment between the big sports books so that they want the content and they want to promote it and present it in the way in which we know they can and do around the world. But they want to do that here in the US to their US customers. And we need to make sure that the structure behind it, in terms of how they pay for it and how that money flows back to the tracks and the horsemen and the various parties involved, that those commercials allow everybody to enable this to start. And additionally, of course, there is a regulatory point, which is we need more states to be in a situation where they can and want to support fixed odds as well as parimutuel. And it's about aligning all of those various and slightly competing factors. But actually, there is an alignment where everybody can pull in the same direction. And I think it was interesting, Steve, that you mentioned it was kind of, you know, fixed odds versus parimutuel. But actually, no, there needs to be an alignment and a coming together of the various different areas. Because in the end, there are a set of customers who like betting, and they like to choose how they want to bet. We know on a sportsbook site they will all be betting fixed odds. So our view is that horse racing via fixed odds on sports betting sites is the way to go. But there will be a role potentially to play for parimutuel in those sites, and we see that around the rest of the world. And it's about how do we get alignment so that everybody can pull in the same direction and present horse racing for what it is, which is the best betting sport in the world. And that's really where we want to try and get to.
I've made the case that when it comes to the sports betting, that it's not a question of racing luring sports bettors as much as giving them an experience with the group of people that you bring up that have thought for years that, well, if I don't have to go to Vegas, if I can bet from home, I could kill the NFL, I'm 8-1 every week until you actually have that opportunity. And those people that had never considered racing, our opportunity was always going to be and will be communicating to that group that are making legal bets for the first time anywhere that, have you just discovered that it's harder than you thought? Why don't you come try a game where you've got a fighting chance? Despite all of our challenges in terms of takeout and everything else, you still have got a better chance betting against other players, other bettors, than you do betting against the house. And in this case, when it comes to sports betting, you're betting against unbelievably insightful professional bookmakers that don't make too many mistakes.
I think we have to look at it this way, and what you say is correct, but we're not getting a lot of new people coming into horse racing. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you walk down the street and say, hey, you want to go to a horse race with me? It's not happening. But we know the people are on these sports books by the millions. And when there's not a football game, a basketball game, that's our opportunity. Horse racing live, it takes a long time. Horse racing on a sports book is really quick because you've got action every 5 minutes. It's short form. And these players are going to bet on something when the majors are not on. And we at SIS are bringing in esports. We do esports on basketball and soccer, and we're finding when their sports aren't on, they're going to bet on that short-form product. So horse racing has a very big opportunity to attract a new group of fans, educate a new group of fans just by being there when there's some downtime from the sports that they normally follow.
And I think those customers are already familiar with the fixed odds approach.
Exactly.
That is how sportsbooks work.
Exactly.
So, you know, they're not going to be put off by the fact that it's fixed odds, because that's everything when it comes to sports betting. So it's a new audience. It's a slightly different format because it's short form rather than long form. There is huge amounts of money going into those sports books to develop the product and make sure it's as entertaining as it can be and as engaging as it can be. And horse racing adds value to that. And so it will become an important part of the mix. And it won't be, you know, once we get going, it'll take time to develop. It'll take time to mature. Various customers will engage with it to different degrees. For some of them, it will become their most important betting sport. For others, it will be a more casual, less frequent bet. But that's fine. That's how this works. And the key thing is getting the content in front of those 130 million customers so that they have a chance to experience it.
Whose responsibility is it, and how can we best make that communication effort, that marketing initiative? Is it an industry obligation, betting site obligation? What's the outreach that works, and do we have a template from that from anywhere else in the world? Hold on. Now you can go to the stick, Mike.
See, I knew I needed the other backup. I don't know which one's live.
It does both. We'll see.
All right. I don't think so.
No, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, no, but right, no. Well, hold on. This thing, there's...
Stand by for technical.
There you go. No, the plug there. The plug. If it gets jostled, if it gets pulled, the headset. It's weird. It cropped up the last couple of weeks.
It's complicated. You know, it sounds like my relationship status is complicated, but that's what it is when we talk about horse racing in the United States, because there are a number of stakeholders, and everyone has a different set of objectives. And not saying any of them are right or wrong. There is. Groups that run ADWs that are very fearful that this is going to cannibalize their business and their bottom line. And then you have racetracks that their purses and funding are coming from alternative forms of gaming, whether it be VLTs or HHR. And let's face it, they're not being funded by parimutuel wagering. And that group has not a whole lot to lose by getting horse racing onto a platform where they can maybe make some headway into someone betting on horses and putting that money back into it. So what it is going to take in the United States is someone to start. Just let's get it onto some, on a bookmaker site or sportsbook site. Let's see how it does. You know, we understand that the U.S. tracks may be reluctant to start, and that's okay. You know, we've put forth some ideas of bringing in international content. Let's see how that fills from the day to the night, mixed in with some U.S. content. You know, we know domestically people want to bet on the home product, just like your home team, no matter what state you're in. But we just need to get this thing started so we'll know what we're talking about here. You know, we're not Australia. We're not the UK. We're something different. And until we try it, we're not going to know how the public is going to respond to it.
But yet, but obviously you're not putting in this effort and you're not making these initiatives, you know, based on idle speculation. You've got projections and you've got an idea of what the market is and what it could be.
So we have sports books whom we know would like to do this, and they are regulated in the states where this is going to become possible. And so, you know, we really are in a position whereby there are still some commercial agreements and some understandings to get to. But part of the reason why we come to these conferences and engage with them is because the people are here and we're having conversations with them, you know, in the next few days to see whether we can get this started. In the end, you know, a major sports book will take this product in a state which has regulated its use for fixed odds, and then we will start to see. And I think we are, at the moment, keeping it really simple, which is that first step is going to be a very important step. And the sooner we can do that, the more we won't be guessing anymore. We'll be looking at real data, and we'll be looking at the real impacts of how the money flows through and how it affects the various elements of the industry, but also how well it goes down with those new customers, with that new audience, looking at the participation and being able to make some proper projections from real data to be able to see how this will all play out. And we do expect that's going to happen this year.
Before we get a status report on jurisdictions, I'm curious to know if we have successfully indoctrinated or won over the horsemen's groups who initially were concerned about the concept because of cannibalization out of the paramutual pools, and then thereby the purse accounts and the money that would flow, you know, out of wagering into coffers, essentially. And I mean, obviously, at this point, these discussions have gone on long enough that and have been fruitful enough that there had to have been some education that has paid dividends.
They keep inviting me back. That's a good sign.
There you go.
No, seriously. You know, one of the first things I hear from racetracks, you'll never get the horsemen to agree. You'll never get the horsemen. And I'm like, no, the horsemen do agree. And, you know, they want the same things we do. We want horse racing to thrive. They're concerned making sure that the money flows back into purses, period. We feel the same way. And, you know, from that aspect, I think many state horsemen's groups are keen to try it. And they understand that. And they have been our biggest supporters thus far in the U.S.
Nice.
And it's funny because I spent 16 years of my life working in paramutual wagering. That's all I did. Now I'm working in fixed odds. But I haven't gotten rid of paramutual. You know, at SIS, we're often told, oh, you are the fixed odds people. This is all you're going to do. It's just not true. We go and represent racetracks and rights holders to maximize the value of their content. And a really good example is some new content we just won. And Richard, you want to talk about that? I can go on about it, but
yeah. Well, so we've been working with the racing authorities down in Australia for some time, looking at what we might be able to do down there. And in the last few weeks, we've managed to sign deals with Racing Victoria and with Southern Australia. So that we now have the rights internationally to distribute their content on 680 meetings a year. And those rights are available to us on a fixed odds basis here in the USA when that becomes possible, but also on a paramutual basis. So I think potentially as early as tomorrow, we will be launching that service with that content into the US market on a parimutuel basis. And Michelle, as well as all of these interviews and all the other things that she's doing, is working very hard to make sure that we hit that deadline.
Wow.
And get that content in front of people here in the USA. So, you know, we are looking to support, I think I've said this to you before, we have content from all around the world. So at the moment in our portfolio, from a fixed odds point of view, we have 28,000 races a year that we would be able to bring into the USA. On a parimutuel basis, it's slightly different because the rights work in a different way, but we're building a portfolio to be able to bring into the USA on a parimutuel basis as well from all around the world. So, as I said earlier on, this is not just about fixed odds versus parimutuel. This is about how do we take the greatest sport in the world and present it in a way to consumers so they're able to play in the way they want to play. And that's what we're really keen and determined to deliver.
I always ask you this question every time we're together. In terms of taking the American racing product and exporting it, how much potential handle influx is possible on going in the other direction?
What's interesting about your question is that this has been happening for over 20 years.
Right.
It's just not something we're talking about a lot. You know, Parks was the first U.S. racetrack to go abroad.
Which might surprise people.
Yep, they have.
And people, they love the signal. The signal is well received.
They call it the Parks effect. And, you know, it came
crazy.
With SIS.
In UK betting shops, it's been a mainstay of that service now for 20-odd years, and people perceive it as being the premium product coming in from the USA. In the UK betting shops, because it's what they're familiar with. It's been there for 20-odd years.
First mover advantage, and
100%. I'm going to let you do the laughing. I mean, look, we enjoy
no, I love,
we enjoy
we
the
love
content
Parks. Parks is just such a funny, it's just such a funny entity, because all of us that play you know that it's a signal that we would love, you know, for management to be as committed as we'd like them to be, when they go the extra mile, like on Pennsylvania Derby Day. It's one of the really good days of racing that people enjoy. But and they have whittled down some of their takeout. But on a going basis, people are just they look at it and they say, especially Monday, Tuesday, like the last couple of days, we had 7 stakes the last couple of days, and you know the American public, it's just a signal that people look at and they say, I would bet this. First of all, if they had a turf course that they were committed to, and they had more turf racing, and if they really worked at it and made an effort to lure, to lure players. So it's so funny that this has been.
Our view is fixed odds plays a part in exactly that.
Yep.
For a lot of tracks around the country, and therefore that's one of the advantages of fixed odds.
There you go.
Because we don't need to have the pool. We do not have that same liquidity that you need in a parimutuel.
There you go. There you go.
So
that's
small,
the difference.
Small and mid-sized tracks
signals
can do really well in fixed odds if they have competitive fields. Full field. We want them full, but we want them competitive. If you've got 2 or 3, 4 horses that could win, no overwhelming favorites, you'll do all right on fixed odds as a small to mid-level track. And it also plays internationally. What time zone is it? So certain content meets certain time zones, and they do better.
Yep.
It's funny, I tell the guys in Louisiana, we send their signal out, and they do really well in Spain. And they're like, we do well in Spain? Why? Timing. What else is out there at the same time? And, what kind of fields do you have? And when you talk about, when you get back to your point here, this has been happening. We've been sending out U.S. content. Not us, it's SIS. We only have a handful of them, but it has been sent out. But I don't think there was a lot of transparency previously in education, both at the racetrack level and the horseman's level. Because from a horseman's standpoint, the Interstate Horse Racing Act, which requires their consent, does not apply internationally. So there were many racetracks sending these signals out internationally, and the horsemen just didn't know about it. Nothing was done wrong. It's just not part of the law. We've seen certain jurisdictions, such as Ohio and Louisiana, Dave Basler, Ed Venanzi, who have written that into their contracts with their negotiations on everything else. We want to see what's going on internationally, and we want to make sure half of that money goes to purses. They've been very successful at that. It's not the case in every state. And so that has been a bit of a hesitation on fixed odds in America, because they know their signals are going out. They didn't know how much was being bet on it, where it was going, and it was scary. And now we're finding with the companies that distribute, there's about three of them here in the U.S. that send signal out.
Who are they?
It would be SIS is the largest in the world as far as international signals and international tracks. The largest exporter of American tracks would be Monarch, XBNet, GWS, the Sternet Group. They have several different names. And then there's a small group that just came in called BetMakers that just got into the business. And, you know, I guess, Richard, you could talk a little bit about SIS when we had only Parks up until recently. And everything was getting sent in through, you know, the Stronet group. But in those times, I just think they were shoved into simulcast contracts. I don't know, think that all of the tracks and horsemen knew exactly where it was going. And now that they do, they're asking really great questions. They're demanding to understand what's happening. And we're trying to get that money flowing back into the purses, you know.
That would have been my follow-up question, which is our horsemen and owners, by virtue of the horsemen negotiations and you know, owners deserve a seat at this table, are they getting the maximum possible return on that export? Because this is a topic, frankly, even internally, domestically, that is not being discussed like it should, because there's certain venues that have essentially discounted their own signal to court specific betting groups and thereby impacting the revenue to horsemen and ergo owners. And no one discusses this, and in some cases, it seems like it's being done to create these bulbous, phony handle numbers that look great when it says, "Oh, record handle," except it might be a record handle, but it wasn't a record return.
Yep.
To coffers that horsemen would have and owners should expect.
And what's interesting is I think we're really caught up in the U.S. looking at handle numbers. You're absolutely right. How much handle did you have? Now, what was your return? If you look at sports betting in the U.S., most of the reports that you see are about what is the gross gaming revenue. What is that? Not necessarily what was handle. And that's something we need to look at as an industry. How do you measure yourself? How do you measure success? And if you're giving that money back and it's going out in expenses or rebates or it's not going to the right thing, well, are you really successful? So you're right. But how this is changing and how the horsemen, the owners, even some tracks can come to the table here is understanding how their product is being used and where it's being sent. And making sure it's simple business, but that's what we need.
This is the same issue that repeats itself from 50 years ago, which is specifically in New York, where the trustees really didn't see what at the New York Racing Association at the time did not see the future as clearly as they should have about what the OTB corporations were going to shake off. And they basically thought, well, it's like finding some money in the street.
Exactly.
No, it's not like finding money in the street. John Nehru tried to get them to understand that they needed to maintain control, and they didn't want to run a business where they, you know, to quote Paul Newman in the Hudsucker proxy, you mean any slob in a T-shirt can buy a share of our stock. They didn't want to be in business with those people. I mean, this is one of the industry's great inequities and poor foresight is understanding who the core customer is in the entire equation. There's only two things we need: owners and horse players. The rest of it will follow suit.
And I think it's different. I mean, as you know, I've been working with SIS for 2 years and a number of other clients. And what I like about what we do is we don't compete. We're not an operator. We don't sell bets. All we do is represent racetracks and content to try to maximize it. And there's a balance. You need to maximize the profit for the racetrack, but at the same time, when you're working with a sports book, you have to make sure it's profitable for them too. So there's that balancing act. And this company wouldn't be in business if it wasn't for racetracks being healthy. And with SIS being a relatively newcomer into the, in a small player into the U.S. market, we may be the largest content provider in the world with all the big content from the U.K. and now Australia and the Middle East. But we had very, very little content from the U.S., and that was Parks. Parks was ours. But I get great pride working with some of these small tracks and seeing the difference that we've made. And I don't want to take the thunder away from the HBPA in Louisiana, but we worked hand-in-hand with Louisiana Downs under their new management with the Horsemen. And last meet, I'm proud to say, we increased their purses 10%.
Wow. Wow.
And we're still growing.
What's that in real dollars?
I don't know what that real dollars is. I'll have to ask Eddie on the real dollar number. He'll be able to tell you. But whether it's 5%, 10%, 20%, the point of it is...
It's found money.
How? And it's not found. It's been there. We're working for it. We're returning it to them.
There you go.
And so we don't...
I think the important thing is this model works on partnership, and it works on the basis of giving visibility to all the various parties as to the real value of the content. And once you can see it, the challenge then becomes, how do we grow it together? Rather than hiding it or not declaring rebates or not declaring, you know, all the various things that otherwise might make it shadowy and difficult to see. No, this works because we give people clarity and visibility of what's happening. And the scenario that we have today isn't going to be the scenario that we have in 2 and 3 and 5 years' time, because once we create that visibility and we create a starting point, all the conversation then becomes about how do we grow it? How do we work with the track? How do we work with the field and the owners and to make sure that the content is as structured as it can be to look like good betting content? And then how do we work with the sports books to make sure it has the right level of prominence, the right level of marketing, the right visibility in order to give consumers the best chance to bet on it?
How much of this potential, excuse me, how much of it can alleviate the... As it came up this morning, we talked with Dick about the way the Gotham was bet. And the incursion of the group money, of CAW money, and the frustration, the vocal frustration of players on value being siphoned out of particularly the exotic pools, because to NAIRA's credit, they've at least improved the landscape when it comes to late odds changes on the win side. The exotic pools are being equated, basically match betting. Can players that are frustrated on that end, can they find a more welcome and more even playing field in the fixed odds realm?
Well, the simple thing to say about fixed odds is liquidity is not an issue. It's not an issue at all. So if a sports book is offering a fixed odds bet on a horse race, that price is a price that the consumer can take. And for those smaller consumers who are betting in, you know, they're not the bigger, more professional punters, for the value that they want to bet at, then it becomes very simple, because the price that's on offer is the price that they can have, and it isn't going to change. So actually, yes, it really does make that market much easier for those smaller customers who I think you're alluding to. So fixed odds is an ideal solution for them.
Yeah, I think... You know, we don't want to say this as, you know, I love horse racing, but we're very unhealthy in the U.S. And I think what's happened here is we're deluded into how healthy we are based on the purse amount. You know, you go into a lot of states, you go into Kentucky where I live, our purses are fabulous. I'm very happy for that, but that's coming from HHR. When you start peeling back our parimutuel pools, there's a lot of high volume professional money in there, and we need it there to keep it going. But it's disproportionate to the retail market. Now, I also work with the Hong Kong Jockey Club, where they're the largest commingled pools in the world, and they have a great mix of pro money and retail money, and they keep that balance, and they work very hard at doing that. In the U.S., we just don't have the retail play that they do elsewhere, and that's why you're seeing the situations that you are, where the pools are unbalanced in the favor of the pros. You know, I don't want to be anti-pro, because we need them, but there has to be a balance.
Well, what is in your experience and internationally, because obviously the batch betting goes on everywhere, what is the maximum allowable percentage of overall pool business that is permissible? Maury Wolf warned 22 years ago, 2000, warned the industry that they could not let it get somewhere between 15 to 20% was as much as Maury at the time warned the industry to not let them become bigger than that amount. And now it's in the, now it, it, who knows, it could be in the mid 30s, low 30s, high 20s. It's to a point where, you know, they're also, famously, I remember Tim Ritvo celebrating that he had managed to bring them in, so they're competing with each other.
And that's true. There is some of that.
Some
happening.
Of that, but not, but it, not to the advantage of the rank and file player.
And I think there's a twofold here. I agree with the number being around 20%, and usually from a player,
as a permissible amount.
Yeah, but from a player, from a high volume player, you usually don't want to put more than 20% into that pool, because then you're going to be playing against yourself. You're no longer going to be playing against it. So that should be a rule of thumb. And I think we're putting these bigger players all into one bucket, and I don't think that's fair. I think we have some high volume groups that, once they have integrity, they know what they can do, what's permissible, what makes sense. And then you have some rogue players over here that they see opportunity and they just jump right on it. They're not thinking about 5 years down the road, how this affects the industry. And I hate to lump them all together for that reason. But why we see high volume players running a bit more rampant than they are anywhere else in the world is because of our rebates, the amount we rebate. It's controlling how much you give back, because they're going to adjust what they bet based on their churn is based on what they get back. And so, you know, in other places, the rebate is limited a lot more than ours. And it's a hard thing to, well, Hong Kong. And how do you control rebates? It's based on host fee. Because you can put in a contract all you want. You can only rebate to this amount. Now, they hope they follow it. But simply, the higher you charge, the less churn you're going to have. So that, to me, it's not having them in the pools that is a problem at all. It's just having different host rates, having different rebates, having different advantages. I mean, even within the high-volume players, there may be some groups that are getting a better deal than another group. Mm-hmm. And so they're at a disadvantage. So I think that's, you know, that's one of our problems here, is how much high-volume play we have. And no one can tell you the exact amount because it's not published. But I can tell you, I've seen some pools here in the U.S., and I've seen as much as 60% in it. Others are less, depending upon how popular they are.
So I'm sure that's true. I think, Steve, you made the right point, which is, in the end, we've got to look at this from the average punter's perspective. And the reason why you're concerned about it is because when it goes wrong, the experience for the average punter is horrible.
Yep.
And they then decide whether they do or don't want to carry on doing this, or whether they want to go and do it somewhere else in markets that you know, are not good for the industry, or indeed they change sports and go and bet on something else in a sports book, which is, you know, an industry which is spending billions of dollars a year to encourage them to do exactly that. So this is about getting that balance right, but we always need to look at it from the average consumer's point of view. That's the key thing here.
As a next step, as we wind down, give everybody regionally, you know, you talked about the legalities that are in place that would offer the opportunity for some of the next steps. Provide us with, you know, kind of an update on that front.
You want to start, Richard?
Well, I think at the moment, you know, there are two states where fixed odds is allowable, in New Jersey and in Colorado. I think New Jersey has been available for some time, but has really struggled to get going. We know there's been some fixed odds betting at the track at Monmouth. What hasn't happened is the sports books have not picked up on it and started to drive it in New Jersey. And from our point of view, this has always been our main focus. This is about sports books. It's not about the tracks. And the political or the regulatory structure within New Jersey is very complicated and difficult. And I think that's put off a number of content owners and a number of sports books from really trying to focus and get going in New Jersey. So unfortunately that's not started. And, you know, you mentioned is it the case that this is a sort of Betfair 2 situation? I don't believe it is. I think there are some specific things in New Jersey which make it really difficult. I think Colorado, we've always been more supportive of the approach that the Coloradan regulator took, which was around a change to the sports betting regulations rather than a complete regulatory change. And at a simple level, declaring that horse racing is a sport and therefore can be bet under those regulations. We think that's much more flexible. We think it allows the sports books to do what they're good at, which is not restrict them to particular bet types, but to allow them to take the sport, focus on it, and be creative in the way in which they offer fixed odds to those consumers, and really, you know, behave as bookmakers, which is what we want them to do. So we are much more supportive of that approach to the way in which the system should come together, and I am hopeful that you know, we're not very far away from having a major sports book go live in Colorado, and that would be our main focus at the moment. Michelle, I'll let you talk about.
Yeah, in other states, I think when sports wagering has come along, with horse racing being the incumbent legal wagering entity, they've looked to protect them when they've put together the regulations. And when I say protection, almost eliminating them in the sense that they're not written in as a sport, they're not there in the rules. And so it's making it actually harder for horse racing because we have to go and either petition that it gets put on as a sport, as a regulation, or there's legislation. Now, we have some states that went as far as saying no horse racing on a sports book, and that has to be changed. So it was done, when these rules were written, it was done to protect horse racing because of the position it had. And horse racing's in a completely different spot than the rest of the sports because so long we're fueled by betting. You know, horse racing would not have existed today if we didn't have betting coming back to it, whereas all the other sports were still around, football, basketball, baseball, they were still around anyway, without betting, and this has been newfound revenue for them, whereas horse racing traditionally always depended on betting revenue to exist. And so they did try to protect them, and that's why we find ourselves in this position where we're going to have to go state by state and say, can this be a sport? And what does that look like? And unfortunately, it may look different in every state how the commercial deals work.
Well, and I remember Dennis Drazen explaining in Jersey, and was it Frank Pallone, one of the politicos, explaining that they were having to classify, you know, what it was going to be, and that was going to make a big difference. Isn't the framework in place in California as well?
On its own, because sports betting is nowhere close to being passed in California.
But for fixed odds, I thought that California that Sacramento had handled this several years ago, actually.
I don't know where that stands on it.
Okay.
You know, and I think the key here is, again,
okay,
sports books. It's getting it on sports books, because it's one thing if you and I walk into a racetrack or an ADW as a horse player, woohoo, yay, we get a choice now, but that's not growing the sport. You know, and,
right,
and that's just transferring
people who are at
money.
The track are already playing.
Yeah.
The incremental opportunity here is to get it in front of these 130 million people who are not and can't. So I think that's why always our focus has been, how do we make sure this is a proposition which the sports books wish to endorse and get behind? Because that's where the incremental growth comes from.
Yeah.
And the newer audience and the younger audience. You know, we know all around the world that horse racing is suffering from having an aging audience. And we know that these sports books, on average, have got customers who are 10, 20 years younger than the average would be for horse racing, and getting it in front of them and turning them into passionate supporters of the sport is one of the key things that we need to do here.
Yeah, and then you go back to New Jersey, and I think they tried to be innovative, but the legislation for this doesn't sit on the horse racing commission side. It doesn't sit with the sports wagering side. It sits in the middle. And who wants to regulate something in the middle? And when they wrote that legislation, they thought they were going to give horse racing this big boon. We're not going to put taxes on it. But when you're depending on a regulatory agency as well to oversee it, and they don't make any money from it, it's not their highest priority either.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things, you know, I think it was done with the right intention to help horse racing, but we're learning there that there's better ways to potentially put that legislation and those rules together. And we see that a little bit with Colorado, and I think the next state we see will be even better than that. So it's a road a slow road we're on, but it'll eventually happen.
How many other jurisdictions is there? The initial road work being done, groundwork.
I know there's 2 to 3 more that are discussing it. You know, that are looking at it. The one that was publicly known was New York. That bill, I don't think it's gone anywhere. But they have been putting it up a few times. They're one that's out in the spotlight, and there's a few others that are, I think, behind closed doors talking about how does this work. And rightly so, the regulators are concerned. They don't want to harm the horse racing industry. So, you know, we give them that. That's a part where everyone has to feel comfortable.
Well, as casual observers, not so casual, but as concerned parties, involved parties, what's your HISA reaction?
We're pointing at each other. I don't know if we want to say that.
I'm no expert on HISA, so I'm going to allow Michelle to take our lead on that one.
Given its omnipresent position.
I think when you look at it from our standpoint, and I'm just going to say it from the betting side, I'm not going to go into how I feel as a horse owner, but it's a lot of noise. You know, one of the things that I think horse racing has done to itself in the last several years is project internally what the public feels, and it's become something that's becoming a reality. We have to fix this because this is broken. And that's not what public perception was. And I think we've created a lot more questions about our industry through the process we're going through at the moment to regulate ourselves. You know, what kind of industry are we? We're constantly fighting with each other about with medications and rules and whips. And we're bringing all the wrong things out to the public. You know, we're doing that as an industry. We're not dealing with our issues internally. We're dealing with it on a public stage. And in today's society, there's just no tolerance for that. And I think ultimately these cases, it is harmful to horse racing, the perception of horse racing, at least at the moment.
No doubt.
And in business anyway, you know, where there is this level of uncertainty, where there is this level of clarity and infighting going on, it's just very unhelpful for investment. It's very unhelpful for planning. And regardless of the public perception, which again, I think you're correct, Michelle, is not good. So, you know, all in all, I think this is something which is not helping. It's holding things back at the moment. And, you know, moving to a much more clear perspective and being able to allow people to invest in where this is going. Because at the moment, it must be causing people to hesitate. And that's not awful.
Do you, as you know, as an international entity, do you find that there is the same external pressures and I hate this term, the social license question? I mean, certainly there's events, you know, with Cheltenham coming up, and when you think about the, you know, the incredible pressure on the Grand National, and then frankly, Melbourne Cup has been under tremendous scrutiny, and in fact, to some degree, even more pronounced than the Grand National. I think I was actually shocked this past November that how angry, the kind of angry reaction to Melbourne Cup was.
A couple of things. I was actually there, so I saw what was happening at the time, and I think the noise around that was perhaps more significant than what I could see happening there and thereabouts within Melbourne. However, you know, we do have a corporate social responsibility here, and attitudes around the world are changing, and we need to be listening to that, and at the same time as putting forward the case as to why we have a great sport and why the people that are in it love the animals and look after them and prepare them in the best way that they can, We also have to be thoughtful that attitudes are changing slightly, and we have to listen to those concerns and make sure that we're taking them into consideration. And I'd say this is something which is happening all around the world in varying different degrees. But the reason why it's happening and the lobbying that's coming and creating the pressure is something which can happen all around the world, and therefore everybody has to take it really seriously. And I know that the industries do. So, you know, I say I'm lucky enough to be able to travel the world and see various different racing authorities and the way in which this is happening. And I know that the people that are in this industry, wherever they are, love it, love the animals, love the overall thing that we're engaged in the time. And so they need to present that really well. They need to make sure that people who are against it have a proper understanding of what works and how it works, because I think there's a lack of clarity an awful lot of the time. They don't want to.
The argument
has to be presented very firmly and correctly and truthfully, and then we also have to listen.
Now, these are zealots. The opponents are zealots. They're wild-eyed zealots. These are the same people that bomb abortion clinics in a very similar fashion. And I'm sorry if that offends. I don't care who it offends. That's just
the
reality.
The issue here is how the mass majority feel about it. And so there are always going to be people who will have extreme views.
Yeah.
The issue for the industry is it needs to make sure that the message for the mass market is understood. Because I think, you know, in the same way that you can see these people as zealots, if the mass market sees them as zealots, then their influence will be diminished significantly. And this is about how does the industry really put forward powerfully the good things that it's doing and embrace that rather than try and shy away from it.
Exactly. Richard Ames, Michelle Fisher.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
Always.
Thanks very much.
Always
nice to see you.
Crackling again. Conversation, provocative. Thank you. We're gonna shift slightly from the animal to human conversation, human connections. Let me grab a picture of the two of you together, if you don't mind. And actually, you know what? Stand behind Shannon, because I'm going to have to get a group shot. Here we go. All right, that's it. Very good. This is how we have to, you know, kind of maximize the opportunity. Beautiful. Outstanding. Oh, this is unbelievable. Let me... Will, sit down. What are you doing? This is a perfect... you know Shannon Kelly, I'm assuming. Right, you know Will. You're kidding. How's that possible? Yeah. Really? All right. Will, you mind? You've got nice hair, too. This is very hard. I hate making people, you know, that have got quality coiffure put on the headset. And Julio, come on, take those. You good? Yeah, come slide a little closer.
Mostly, yeah.
You're good. You're fine. All right. Shannon Kelly from the... Safety Net Foundation of the Jockey Club, and who we talked to 4 months ago.
Yeah, probably more than that. Maybe it was. Could it be more than that?
It could have been. It could have been in the summer. I was doing that series of conversations, Grace and Jockey Club, and we did Equibase stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to put personality and face to all of the various Jockey Club information systems and everything. But we also, I was also reached out to you with some specific. Safety net concerns. The horseman labor side of things, represented by Will Velley, who we haven't talked to in a good long time, knock on wood, because the longer I go without having to talk to you, the less trouble we have. Julio Rubio here from Kentucky HBPA, and the pressure has eased when it comes to the H-2B visas, and I can't imagine why that would have been. I wanted to put the three of you together because the human side of it, and Shannon, Backstretch employees when it comes to Safety Net, and it's not limited to Backstretch employees, and Will and Julio, the work that you do when it comes to representing the needs of the horsemen, particularly for personnel, and I think it's healthy that we haven't heard of employee shortage concerns over basically the past, I don't know, year plus.
There has been a marked sea change in the way that the administration treats our workers and the whole concept of immigration since the new administration came in. I was at an H-2B coalition meeting for all the different industry groups, and the there was a member of USCIS Immigration there who actually was thanking us for helping meet the needs of the labor needs of industry and telling them that we're partners. We've never been treated like that before under Trump or Obama, as strange as that was. Even under Obama, one job that was given to a visa was considered a job lost by an American. But this administration understands that these are job multipliers. They're coming here to serve a very vital, foundational labor need, and that without their help, we can't meet our supply chain needs and the inflation abatement.
There's one component here that it occurs to me that I could have drawn in, assuming I think he's still here, is Doc McClellan and the work that Groom Elite has done. I, as it happens at Gulfstream, when we were doing the Gulfstream shows about 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, the Groom Elite was in the middle of a class that the Florida Florida team had put together, and it quite something. They basically were starting as I was finishing the show the last half hour, and it was something. When I actually asked Reed, I said about support, industry support, and Shannon, you can talk to Safety Net on this same topic. I said to Reed, are you getting adequate support from around the industry? And he said, do you want the honest answer? And the honest answer was no, which is really concerning. I mean, that here you've got a entity that is training, turning hot walkers into grooms. And then also, of course, he's also got the course that turns grooms into assistant trainers and shed row foremans. So when it comes to the infrastructure and the underpinnings of the human side of this, it's hand in glove with the supposed mission of everybody in the industry about safety and integrity and the welfare of the horse. You would think that bringing in as much quality labor as possible, educating them to a maximum threshold to care for the horses and be a partner in with the trainer and being able to inform them of concerns and nuances that they've been taught to watch for in the horse. This is all an infrastructure that is intertwined.
Well, it should be.
Yes.
I mean, I think, we tend to put these topics in two different categories. We have people that are advocating for the horse, and then we have people advocating for the human. And I mentioned in my roundtable speech this summer that we cannot continue to keep them in separate categories because it's all the same. And it goes to your point, a program like Groom Elite, you're investing sometimes millions of dollars into one horse. Mm. And the fact that you would not want the person caring for that horse to be at its highest level of skill set seems crazy to me. I mean, and I think it's a industry culture shift. I think, obviously my family's been in horse racing for 100 years, right? So when my grandfather was training horses, it fell on him when he brought in new people to train the people or train his top guys to then, when the new guy came in, they taught him what to do and how to touch the horse and the right way to approach it. I mean, it's truly a skill that when we're bringing in these workers, if they're from out of the country, I mean, we are wanting to let people know that any critic that might come our way is that we are training a skilled workforce. This is not anybody can do this job. It's a specific job and we need them. And it's different than any other job that you're bringing people in for. So, you would think that it would be a combined effort for people, whether you fall in the horse category or the human category. It has to be intertwined because we don't have one without the other.
And similarly, it occurs to me, and I don't know if it falls to somebody like Groom Elite or if it falls to Horseman Labor Solutions, Will and the tentacles that you apply and HBPA and THA, mm-hmm. but citizenship courses and Who's handling that? Is there a clearinghouse for helping immigrants become U.S. citizens?
I know that for Kentucky, the Learning Center, they do...
Backside Learning Center.
Yes, they teach, you know, the when you go in and the questions, the 200 questions you have to learn so when you get tested. So they have that program. And then as far as the paperwork, I help out, me and Will help out with the paperwork.
Yeah.
That's an isolated. I'm curious. I mean, is there? We've got Anna House and you know the.
I know that in specific areas, like I mean, obviously I'm most well versed in New York. I know that a lot of chaplaincies and horseman organizations and individual racetracks put on programs. Whether it's come in here and speak with a lawyer today about you know whatever it is, or ESL classes, or you know here's how to deal with X issue, right?
Yes, and we work a lot with the chaplaincy in New York and everywhere where the racetracks are as far as immigration issues. We always, you know, guide them to what they need to do.
Just to give you an example, right here at Fairgrounds, Chaplain Waverly Parsons is one of the great chaplains you'll ever meet. He's, you know, one of the people, and he goes out, he gives English classes, he gives citizenship classes. We talk to him on a regular basis to see if there's anything we can do to help with, you know, whatever needs he has. And that's just one example of how broad the chaplaincy's reach is amongst the tracks. They are some of the best movers for the interests of the people.
The first line of defense, truly.
When it comes to the quality of life collectively, that's one area that I'm just thinking about the Safety Integrity Task Force and the accreditation program. Does it include housing and you know the social infrastructure at the racetracks for backstretch personnel?
Yes,
it does.
Yes.
Okay.
One of the great things as far as the workers that we bring with the visas is they have housing and assistance with medical. For example, in Kentucky, we have the Kentucky Health and Welfare Fund. So if you work for a trainer, as long as you have a pay stub and a license, you have medical help. So does Indiana. I think New York does also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do. And we work at Safety Net. We work with Kentucky Health and Welfare Fund all the time. Pretty often we go together on an issue. So while they can cover all the medical issues,
right.
There are situations that don't fall. And I was just talking about this morning at our little breakout session where we talked to benefit providers. And I talked about how Safety Net can be a resource because a lot of times these issues are twofold. So while the Kentucky Health and Welfare can make sure that they have an X amount of benefit that they can pay towards when it comes to medical, what happens when that person needs assistance that does not fall in the medical category?
Right.
And that's where Safety Net comes in. So we work, we rely on all these organizations because not one of us can handle all of the issues.
Right, and so one of the things that I do or we do is like a work call come and maybe it's not an immigration issue, it's, you know, and we hear what their need is, and so what we try to do, we send them the right direction to a resource, somebody that can help them with what they're going through. And also another thing that New York and Kentucky offers to the employees is a retirement plan for free.
Wow.
And it doesn't matter as long as you work for a trainer, you have a license, they get when they turn 52, I think 55, they get a pension.
Yeah, I think my uncle is on that pension board for NYCHA.
Which is great.
Yeah.
He's on every board.
Well, he's
on
every board.
who are you kidding?
we cover a lot of them. I think there are, and I think one thing that is always the issue that we have in horse racing, and I don't know what the right solution is, but, you know, because we're all individual jurisdictions, you have pockets that have great resources. But we sometimes need to remember that not every racing jurisdiction has the ability or the funds or the access to all of these things. So, you know, it's... it's the responsibility sometimes of safety net to come in when in an area that might not have those things. We can't, you know, solve some of these issues at whole, but we can give some money towards one part of the problem, whereas in places like New York and Kentucky and California and Florida, they have so many of the resources available, and Louisiana too. They have such great resources. You know, we don't often, I was talking this morning with somebody from Louisiana that was like, you know, we've never called you because we are able to handle a lot of the benevolence cases that come our way, which is great to hear. I don't want you to have to call me.
It allows you to apply those resources elsewhere. I know I asked you this last year when we talked, but are you adequately funded and you know, how much more could...
I mean, the more money we raise, the more money I can give. I mean, at the current way we're set up, we give about $500,000 a year in assistance. Now, do we raise that $500,000? No, we obviously have investments and a portfolio and things like that that we dip into. I mean, I've always said that I hope one day I get to the point where I'm raising X amount of dollars a year that would cover all of that.
Maybe I'm being naive, but that doesn't sound like a lot of money, half a million.
Probably doesn't with the issues that we have. I mean, yeah, I mean, but we also have to realize that those are cases that maybe half of it is covered elsewhere by some other benevolent organization.
Good point. That's fair. Ed, we got about 4 minutes to give you both a shot.
There's always resources out there to help that, you know.
Do we feel that everybody on the backstretch knows where to go in a time of need?
I think as far as the tracks, like, I mean, because we go all over the place. I think like Maryland, New York, Kentucky, Indiana, Florida too, they usually go and speak with someone.
Mm-hmm.
And I will get a call. I get calls from like all over the country. I mean, the East Coast mainly, not California. But sometimes, you know, someone needs help with something and they call me because that
and you
jurisdiction
mm-hmm.
doesn't have the resources, they don't know what to do. So
they know where to go.
To
where to turn.
They know where to go. Yes.
So between the combination of the THA and the HBPA and the chaplaincies, there is a network. I'm sure there's always room for improvement. Mm-hmm. This is a difficult job. It's difficult working conditions, and people deal with stresses on the backside of the track in sometimes, you know, not the most beneficial ways to themselves. But, you know, if we can try to be here, at least as a resource to get them to the right direction, then, you know, that's a good step forward.
We spoke at the Racetrack Chaplains of America conference a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. where all the chaplains met in one sitting. And so, you know, we let them know that if they need any help, you know, we're there to kind of put a face to them for us.
Well, for you, before we wrap, is there any area that needs to be communicated that hasn't been covered in recent conversations?
Well, I love the fact that you brought up Doc McClellan, because in 2005, he at my very first conference, HBPA, he said, I would do this for free, but I just need the resources to help, you know, the Groom Elite program go. And we have set up a program through Remy Bellick and Reed where we're going to expand through a visa called the H3. It's a two-year visa. If the trainer pays a tuition, a modest tuition, to Groom Elite, then we can use this training visa. The person can come over. We filed for two French women who are going to work at breeding farms in Kentucky, two Brazilians that are going to work in a reining horse facility, and one Irishman who is going to work as an assistant trainer here at Fairgrounds. So this is just in the last, you know, few weeks that we've developed this out. It's a comprehensive program, not just for racing, but for all the different disciplines and parts of the sport. And this is going to be a way to fund the program to keep helping Americans take care of. And we're going to talk more about this in the panel here at 12:30. So,
all right, and then you come back to me, and we'll get. Is there a name for this program?
Well, it's the Groom Elite program.
But no, not the Groom Elite side. But
the visa is called an H3.
The H3.
Yes.
So, well, because I was really, I mean, Reed, I think, was frankly moved that I asked if you had enough industry support, and he was almost shy about saying no, and I mean it's preposterous that you know that the industry is not all in on helping him develop and let him train others to train a wider array. Mm-hmm. It benefits everybody and every owner, you would think, and the breeders, everybody. I mean, everybody should be behind it, and you guys are part of the conduit system, and you know that whenever you need to communicate anything, feel free. Thank you very much. Will Velli and Julio Rubio and Shannon Kelly. It's like a Chinese menu of one from each category that pitched in today. This has been an insane 3 hours. Thanks as well to Richard Ames and Michelle Fisher. Sid, we're not going to get to Sid, it looks like, this week, because he's tied up both tomorrow and Friday. So we'll save Sid for next week when I'm home in New York for 4 days before we head to Ocala. Thanks as well, Dick Powell, of course, and Eric Hamelbeck. Ed Martin with a fabulous visit, and also Dr. Doug Daniels, the National APA president. This was a furious 48 hours here at the Hotel Monteleone. Really enjoyed, as always, bringing you scenes from the HBPA convention. We're all in the same boat, as it were, and it's a good time to bring in my LBJ comment, famous quote, "Don't spit in the soup, we've all got to eat it." Talk to you from Vegas tomorrow morning, everybody. Replay 6 to 9 here on SiriusXM. Archive podcast later at stevebick.com.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio. Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program.